starts the same way, with confidence, with a quiet, unshakable belief, we're fine, we're in control, nothing can touch us. On a cold night in April 1912, aboard the RMS Titanic, passengers dressed in elegance laughed in their dining rooms, walked on the polished decks under the stars. The ship, this marvel of human engineering, it had been called unsinkable. Even after the iceberg struck, many didn't panic. Why would they? The lights were still on, the music was still playing, the ship felt steady beneath their feet. Some passengers delayed getting to the lifeboats. Others waved them off. It's just a precaution. This ship won't go down. It can't. But then something shifted. The deck tilted, just slightly at first. The air turned sharp with urgency. Orders grew louder. The reality became unavoidable. And in that moment, a terrifying realization spread across the ship. They had trusted something that could not save them. And now it was too late. 36 years earlier than that, on the plains of Montana, George Armstrong Custard rode forward in the same confidence into battle of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. He was bold, experienced, battle-tested. He divided his forces because he believed the enemy was weak and scattered and totally manageable. But as the dust rose in the horizon, as the hills began to fill with warriors, and the sound of hoofbeats multiplied beyond expectation, the truth became clear. He hadn't charged into victory. He had ridden straight into an overwhelming opposition. And by the time he realized it, he was surrounded. No escape, no reinforcements, no second chance. The battle he thought he controlled was already lost. There are few things more terrifying than realizing too late that you are on the wrong side. History is filled with moments where people thought they were secure, until suddenly everything collapsed. I'm sure you can think of a historical event. I just picked two that hopefully were a little bit famous, that it wouldn't be totally new to you, right? But cities can be fortified, armies can be prepared, wealth can be accumulated. And yet, when the decisive moment came, these people fell. And that's what Nahum 2 shows us. Nineveh, at that time, the most powerful city in the world, felt untouchable, military dominance, economically rich, politically secure. But Nahum pulls back the curtain and shows us something deeper. When God comes against a people, no strength can save them. And this is not just about Nineveh. This is about every person who stands opposed to God. Now, remember last week, we started the book of Nahum. Nahum was written to God's people who were under the oppression of Nineveh. It's like Nineveh and their forces were right at Judah's door. And they were being oppressed and they were fearful because of this mighty force that was going to overtake them. The north had already been overtaken. Judah was still technically intact, but they were petrified of what was going to happen to them. And so God gives Nahum a vision to write to encourage Judah. And in this encouragement, he is telling Nineveh, they're done. He's powerful and he's coming for them and there's nothing that they can do about it. And this week is like the battle scene of what he's going to do. Last week was his power and his certainty and how he's going to come in vengeance and defeat the enemies and how he is our refuge. That was last week. But this week, it's the final judgment. It's the battle scene. Our text tonight in Nahum 2, we see the theme, God's enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. God's enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. Now, the passage unfolds in five movements or five scenes that shows us exactly what God's final judgment is going to look like. The first scene, we see that in verses 3-4, they will see and fear their attackers. The second movement is verses 5-6, their defenses will be futile. The third movement, their city will fall and be drained in verses 7-10. And then in verses 11-12, we see there will be no more. And finally, in verse 13, all this happens because the Lord has come against them. So let's look at the first point, verses 3 through 4. All right, I'm going to read it again so it's fresh. Verse 3, the shield of his mighty men is red. His soldiers are clothed in scarlet. The chariots come with flashing metal on the day he musters them. The cypress spears are brandished. The chariots race madly through the streets. They rush to and fro through the squares. They gleam like torches. They dart like lightning. So in point one, we see that they're going to see and fear the attackers. Nahum opens with this vivid, almost cinematic imagery. In graphic terms, Nahum describes the swiftness of the attack and the divisive defeat of Nineveh. Parts of this section could refer to either the attackers or the defenders of the city. Now, if you look back at verse 1 of 2, chapter 2, that's why I wanted to read it. It says, the scatter has come up against you. The scatterer is the enemy, and yet, but when you go to verses 3 and 4, the he there, we're not exactly sure if the he is the frightening, the enemy attackers, or the ones who are frightened. But regardless, you're supposed to have this scary imagery because they wore red uniforms and carried red shields. The red shields could be bloodstained, or it could just be intimidating paint. We don't know that, but that red is just supposed to be, it's supposed to invoke fear because it could be blood or it could just be in a scary attack color. Like that's what the poet here, Nahum, is saying in his song of judgment. So whether it's red blood or painted blood, the color is meant to invoke a thought of blood, and therefore it would have presented a fearsome sight. Now, Nahum continues the thought of coming destruction by describing the chariot's swift and relentless advance. There's a flashing metal, the sun reflects the metal adornments, while the infantry marches and their spear shafts swing back and forth as they advance on the attack. Chariots racing wildly, the scene is set in the city where defenses are being readied for onslaught. Horses rush about the city. Confusion reigns. What you're supposed to see is fear and chaos right here. Nahum wanted to convey the idea of panic and fear in Nineveh as they watch the powerful army set forth against them. Nineveh will see the attack coming and have great fear. Nineveh is no longer the aggressor. They're the ones being attacked. This scene is an unstoppable advance. The army is not hesitating. They are not regrouping. They are not uncertain. They are coming. Fast, focused, unstoppable. Nineveh is not wondering if judgment will come. It's already at the gates. Notice the tone. There's no suspense here. There's no, well, maybe, or if they can hold out kind of language. Everything reads like it's already decided, because it is. God has decreed it. God's judgment is certain. God's judgment will be visible, undeniable, and terrifying. There will be no confusion about what is happening. So think about a sudden military invasion or even a natural disaster warning that comes too late. First, people see it. It's calm in today's age. They have their phones out watching it, right? They see it. It's just something to watch. Then it's coming towards them, the storm, the army, the destruction, and suddenly fear grips them. If you know anything about American bison, we call them buffalo, but technically they're American bison. They are unpredictable, powerful wild animals that can switch from calm to aggressive in seconds, frequently attacking when startled, cornered, because they're protecting their calves. Despite this a sometimes docile appearance, they are dangerous. Buffalo attacks happen, particularly in Yellowstone National Park, largely because of the ignorance of tourists. The tourists underestimate them. They don't realize how scary and how dangerous buffalo are. They mistake them for these docile cow-like animals because they are just kind of standing there. I mean, you can see why they're stupid, but you really shouldn't be stupid when you go to a national park. But the tourists, you know, they advance forward to see them better because they don't seem like they're a danger. They creep closer and closer. They want to get that perfect picture right. And then suddenly the buffalo attacks. And that's what Nahum is describing here. The moment when denial turns into dread. This is how the Bible speaks about judgment. We tend to think, I'll deal with that later. I've got time. It's not that serious. But Nahum says, judgment is not uncertain, it's settled. If you're outside of Christ, you are not moving toward a possibility of judgment. You are moving towards a certainty of God's judgment. Let me just say that again. If you are outside of Christ, you're not moving towards a possibility of judgment. You are moving towards a certainty of God's judgment. God's enemies will experience terror of his final judgment. So now we move to point two, how we see their defenses will be futile. Verses 5 and 6 read, he remembers his officers. They stumble as they go. They hasten to the wall. The siege tower is set up. The river gates are open. The palace melts away. The palace melts away. The attacking army has reached the walls. In confusion, Nineveh scrambles to respond. Officers are called. Stumbling troops rush to defend in their panic. Walls are manned. But it's too late. In verse 6, Nahum continues to describe the attack on Nineveh by describing the physical surroundings and protections of Nineveh. Any attacker in that day would have to deal with the Tigris River that Nineveh was situated on. It also had a river, the River Hasor, that ran through the city. Now, these rivers provided natural protection for Nineveh, but they also provided to be the downfall of the city. The opening of the river gates resulted in the collapse of the palace, which is described as melting. Now, we are on this side of history, or we can actually look at the accounts of what happened to Nineveh. And because we know about historical accounts, we know that when Babylon and the Medes attacked Nineveh, the fall of Nineveh happened with the city being conquered by diverting the waters of the Tigris so it went into the city. That's how Babylon took Nineveh. The description of the destruction in verse 6 focuses on the palace or the inside the walls of Nineveh. As the defenses of the city are overwhelmed, the palace reacts in fear and is ultimately destroyed. Even their natural defenses betrayed them. The river floods. The city is exposed. Everything Nineveh trusted in begins to collapse. Nineveh was one of the most fortified cities in the world at the time. Massive walls, advanced military, strategic defenses, but none of them mattered because when God acts, nothing can stand. Leaders stumble, defenses fall, structures dissolve. The imagery is overwhelming. It's like the city is melting under pressure because when God acts, nothing can stand. No human defenses can stand when God has determined judgment. So think of a tsunami. You can't negotiate with a tsunami. You can't stop it. You can't stand against it. All your strength, your preparation, it doesn't matter. Any scientific discovery or fortified, it doesn't matter. When it comes, it overwhelms everything in its path. In the same way, God's judgment cannot be held back by human effort. So what do people trust in today? I mean, this is easy. They trust in their money. They trust in power they have, influence, their reputation, their own strength. Maybe they have great health they're trusting in, their determination. But Nahum shows us when God's power is directed against you, there is no resistance that works. There is nothing you can do or have that will stand before God. You cannot out-prepare divine judgment. God's enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. Point three, this is verses 7 through 10. Here is where the city will fall and be drained. 7 says, its mistress is stripped. She is carried off. Her slave girls lamenting, moaning like doves and beating their breasts. Nineveh is like a pool whose waters run away. Halt, halt, they cry, but none turn back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There is no end of the treasure or of the wealth of all the precious things. Desolation and ruin. Hearts melt and knees tremble. Anguish is in all loins. All faces grow pale. Their city will fall and be drained, is point three. The battle's over. The city's defeated. Now we see the aftermath. The city collapses. The people flee. Wealth is plundered. Everything Nineveh built is stripped away. Verse 7, the city mistress is stripped and carried off. It's probably their goddess Ishtar. The image of this goddess was dishonored by the defeat of her city and was carried away. It was common in warfare for the victor to remove the cult statues of their defeated enemies and carry them to their own temples. The Philistines did this with the Ark and for Samuel. They thought the Ark of the Covenant was Israel's equivalent to the image of God. As the statue of the goddess is carried away in verse 7, the inhabitants mourn. The text specifically mentions the girls who were in service to the Ishtar cult. They mourn by pounding their breasts to express their distress over what has happened. Now, some people think slave girls are mentioned to show it's the weakest who are left in the city to mourn the defeat of Nineveh. In verse 8, we see more imagery to reflect the destruction of Nineveh through water. Nineveh is likened to a pool of water which has ruptured and is impossible to hold back the escaping waters. In this case, the water would stand for the fleeing defenders. The desertion of the soldiers leaves the city open to the plundering that verse 9 describes. Now we hear the attackers as they take over the city as they cry, "Plunder! Plunder!" Nineveh was one of the most powerful and wealthiest of cities on earth at the time, and its conquerors took full advantage of the opportunity to possess all of Nineveh's treasures. This section ends with verse 10, summarizing the fear that will overtake those who observe the destruction of Nineveh. Absolute terror. The repetition emphasizes it with desolation and desolate. There is nothing left to rebuild. Nineveh is finished. God's judgment empties what we trust in. So think of a financial collapse. Someone spends decades building wealth only to lose it overnight. Everything they trusted in disappears. Poof, gone. All their hope in earthly things. That's Nineveh. A lifetime of security gone in a moment. So ask yourself, what am I building my life on? What is my hope in? What would happen if those things were taken away? God's judgment reveals what is temporary. God's enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. In point 4, we see there will be no more in verses 11 and 12. Verse 11 says, "Where is the lion's den, the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion and the lionesses went, where his cubs were with none to disturb? The lion tore enough for his cubs and strangled prey for his lionesses. He filled his caves with prey and his dens with torn flesh." Nahum is now turns to taunting Assyria. He ridicules Nineveh. The nation is now strong and powerful, but will soon succumb to overwhelming power of God. He uses the imagery of a lion as he taunts Assyria with insults. Historically, Nineveh called themselves a lion. They were known as a lion because of their power, their dominance, how they were unstoppable, how they were ruthless, and how they were feared. They would use lion tactics themselves. The armies of Assyria ruthlessly attacked its prey, strangling its enemy cities and bringing their prey to its lair. Assyria wanted to be known in this ruthless way. A century before Nahum, Isaiah recognized the lion-like nation of Assyria. He talks about Assyria in Isaiah 5:29. He says, "Their roar is like that of a lion. Their roar like young lions. They growl as they seize their prey and carry it off with no one to resume." And now, according to Nahum's gods, God's purpose was to destroy Assyria. Nahum turns this dominant lion imagery against Nineveh. Now the lion is attacked. God mocks them in verse 11. Nahum uses rhetorical question here like he did back in chapter 1 when he said in chapter 1, who can stand this God, right? Who can be before him? Well, here he's taunting with the rhetorical question of the lion's dwelling. Where is it? Remember, it's been destroyed. Where's this lion's den? It's nowhere. It's gone. It's weakened. It's not weakened. It's not reduced. It's completely gone because God destroyed it. Assyria feels self-sufficient and invincible, but God will bring an end to that attitude. Verse 12 continues the taunt with the description of the lion devouring its prey. The ferocity of the lion filled his lair with food for the lioness and the cubs. The image is one of brutality. Their cruelty was unparalleled. They used to be wildly successful, but where is the scourge of the earth now? Verse 12 affirms that Assyria will no longer be this all-power among the nations. God's judgment removes even the strongest powers permanently. So human strength today does not guarantee survival for tomorrow. Power, our power, human power, is temporary. Only God is eternal. God's enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. So now we're at our last point, point five. All this happens because the Lord comes against them. Verse 13 reads, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messenger shall no longer be heard." Our passage concludes with a judgment oracle against Assyria, using the metaphorical language, more imagery of the lion that was mentioned in verses 11 and 12 to describe Assyria's punishment. Verse 13 is almost like a summary of the whole chapter. Verse 13 opens with the Lord's great displeasure of Assyria. "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts." This is the most important verse, and it's the most terrifying verse. Everything we've seen, the terror, the failure, the collapse, is because God himself is against them. Four closing related phrases follow this, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts." And these four phrases express the disaster that God will bring on them. The first one is, "I will burn your chariots in smoke." The second is, "The sword shall devour your young lions." The third is, "I will cut off your prey from earth." The fourth is, "The voice of your messenger shall be no longer be heard." The first and fourth phrase speak directly to the issue, where the second and third are metaphorical phrases. The words chariots, lions, prey, and messengers all refer to the strength of Assyria. The Lord himself intends to reduce Nineveh's strength to rubble. So this, the first section, the first phrase, "I will burn your chariots in smoke," Nineveh used the weapons of chariots to intimidate and destroy. And God would use those same resources to bring an end to Nineveh and deliver the people of Judah. The second phrase, "the sword shall devour your young lions." Well, young lions connect to those previous verses, verses 11 and 12, referring to the power of Nineveh. Here the young lions have no power, for they'll be taken out by the sword. The third phrase, "I will cut off your prey from earth." The picture of the young lions continues in this phrase. Nineveh has prospered by subjecting people. If Nineveh's armies could not bring back its prey, they would suffer and ultimately fall prey to a greater force. The fourth phrase, "the voice of your messenger shall no longer be heard," Nineveh has sent its messengers and envoys throughout its sphere of influence. Now this haughty city will have no more representative heralds, for no one remains to be represented. So verses 13 contains four pieces of evidence of the coming end of Nineveh, because the Lord of the universe is against Nineveh. Their chariots will be burned, the sword will devour their soldiers, no one will be brought back to Nineveh, the voices of their messengers will be silenced. With vivid words and powerful metaphors, Nahum described the coming destruction of Nineveh as if it had already taken place. The Lord reigns. No nation can last who turns their back on God. Through these verses, the Lord showed himself to be the Lord of the universe. He has declared this already in the last chapter, but here he shows his power over Nineveh. The Lord is working history to accomplish his righteous plan. The enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. The greatest danger in life is not hardship. It is God being against you. If God is for you, nothing can ultimately destroy you. Scripture confirms God is for you through promises of presence, his protection, his unconditional love. And God's people in Nahum's day knew this because Isaiah wrote in Isaiah 41:10, "Fear not, I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, I will help you, I will uphold you by my righteous right hand." Though you may be thinking of his promise of protection and presence and unconditional love from the New Testament, most notably in Romans 8:31, "If God is for us, who can be against us?" If God is for you, nothing can ultimately destroy you. But if God is against you, nothing can ultimately save you. God's enemies will experience the terror of his final judgment. So this raises the most important question. Is God for you or against you? Ladies, either you responded in your head with comfort or with fear. Is God for you or is he against you? Nahum points us forward to when God will judge all his enemies. Nineveh's judgment is a preview of something greater. Final judgment. Jesus himself says in Revelation 22:12, "Behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me to repay each one for what he has done." Jesus' final promise in the Bible regarding his imminent return is what we read here in Revelation. It highlights accountability, encouraging believers that their faithful actions are recognized and that he will justly reward believers and judge the wicked. It offers Christians hope, reminding believers of the pain of their struggles is temporary and justice is coming. He's coming again, and when he comes, he will bring his wrath, his terror, and his judgment to his enemies. So where do you connect in this area? Maybe it's in sin, maybe it's a weakness you have with the message of this text. What is your need in the face of wicked powers that seem too great to be dismantled? How do the specifics of coming attacks on Nineveh help meet that need? Well, we may fear justice may never be done. We may fear the wicked will just get a slap on the wrist. But those who fail to repent and turn to the Lord will face them as his enemy. And they will experience the fullness of the Lord's wrath. They will be terrified at his advance, unable to defend against him. Their strength and accomplishments will be swiftly torn down. Their destruction will be mocked as a thing of the past that will never rise again. We may fear the gospel can have unjust outcomes. Maybe someone evil turned to the Lord and they're spared God's wrath. And that is somehow not right, you might feel. But the wrath Christ suffered on the cross more than pays for the sins of the repentant. Christ's declaration, "It is finished," and the Father raising him from the dead testifies to this. On the cross, Jesus experienced what Nahum described. Jesus experienced terror, judgment, God's wrath. He stood where God's enemies deserve to stand, so that those who trust him will never face God as an enemy. Imagine standing in a courtroom and you're guilty. The sentence is about to be read. Then someone steps forward and says, "I'll take that punishment." That's what Christ did for us. We tend to underestimate God's judgment, trusting in worldly security, assuming we can stand when God comes against us. But we need to take judgment seriously. Don't treat it as a distant thing or a symbol. It's real, it's certain, and it's coming. Stop trusting in false security. Your success won't save you. Your morality won't save you. Your reputation won't save you. Only Christ saves. Find comfort if you are in Christ. If you belong to Jesus, God isn't against you, he's for you. The judgment that you should have, he's already taken on. Nahum 2 shows us a terrifying reality. When God comes against his enemy, they can't stand. They will fear, their defenses will fall, their security will collapse, they will be gone. And it all happens because God himself is against them. But the gospel gives us hope. You don't have to face God as your enemy. Through Jesus, you can know him as Savior. So the question is simple as we close. Will you face God as your judge or trust Christ as your substitute? Because the day is coming, and when it does, no one will stand unless you are in him.